What?
Did I say that?
I can't. No, they are talking about something about they're talking about mushrooms and how certain like intelligence.
We went into Terrence McKenna.
Right.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then I thought, yeah, you might start a mushroom craze via the drops because as a new vehicle, because they were almost implying that, you know, that these would open you up or contain spores of, you know.
Well, that's what James Kidney interpreted, man. RNA stands for real nice acid.
Yes.
Yeah, there's some people take it that way. Okay, I think.
I would describe that as correct, yeah. Yeah, and then actually I thought, yeah, you can start it via the drops. And then he says, well, not mushrooms in particular, but substances in the area he was.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And everyone's taking drugs even back in the Stone Age. It never stopped.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, Madeline, I think, wants to say something.
Madeline wants to say two things. One is, Dave, why wouldn't you identify yourself in the chat room?
What do you mean?
He was Dave.
I didn't know if there's you're not the only Dave.
Oh, I see.
He was from
you meant should I say Dave Neufeld? Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Because I thought you meant is there's more than one Dave on here. Which Dave are you? And so, but I only saw Dave 207.
You were the one typing.
Yes. Yes.
So you're saying that
I thought it was you, so it's okay.
Yeah.
So you're saying because you knew of other Daves, you didn't know whether it was Neufeld or not. But Dave didn't know there were other Daves.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I thought there was another person that might have had Dave, but I didn't think they were on this one. So I assumed, right. Oh, there must be a Dave usually on the other ones, but she's wondering which Dave is this.
Right. And what was the second thing?
What Madeline said?
No, I'm asking Madeline. She said her site. She had two things. What's the other point, Madeline?
I might have been a bit delirious, but No, this actually was happening. I have to listen to it again, though. But did you notice that I anticipated the rewrite content in my conversation with Akito? And or you responded to our conversation in the rewrite?
Okay, I don't know if I noticed it. But tell us what happened.
I said I couldn't really do that. Well, remember the part where I got myself all befuddled trying to talk about force fields and all those people in Japan?
Right. Now, was that in the last couple of days or over in Dupes weeks ago?
No, this was this morning.
Okay, no, I may not have read that. So, yes, you're doing that.
No, we spoke on the...
Oh, okay. All right. So then what?
And then after that, you played the 3 hours of rewrite, and you went to bed, and I listened, and I heard you talking about what I had been talking about with Akito.
I see. Now, that would be this. I don't fall asleep until I don't go to bed. I'm listening, and I fall asleep. That is the second three-hour installment. Are you talking about the first installment?
The second installment, right. Yeah.
Right.
It was
and,
neat.
It was neat that you had your own Allison synchronicity with the content.
Yeah, right.
Okay, we got that registered. It's very complex getting it precisely identified what the fuck you guys are saying sometimes.
You were talking about humans having to get along.
Really? I talked that corny topic? Jeez.
You did.
Can't we all get along? That kind of stuff? I do not do that. I do not do that.
No, you probably got affected by the whole Jimmy Stewart moments you were experiencing when everyone was gathered around.
Love of Bob.
Bob survived
the
war. He's back. It was the war hero part.
The war hero. Suddenly Bob is the greatest champion who's ever happened. And Bob is a god.
Now it's the next day after. All right, you're going to have to get a job. You're going to the party's over. Everyone on the streets back to their work. Oh,
well, that happened to Reverend Ivan Stang, you know. Did you know that happened to Stang?
No,
he did the big X day on July.
Oh, right.
No, on July 5th, 1998, they did the big X Day up in upstate New York, And you see his wife teacher running around with the Friday, who was the, one of the main women in the group, and she has to speak, and she's all worried. Have I got it down, Friday? Can I do it? And she's all worried, and this is all on the movie or the documentary you bought back then, and she's all worried, and then she ends up in front, and she does her performance, and it's sort of mediocre, or it's hard to tell whether it's good or not. And then after, she's all worried that it wasn't good enough, because she wanted to give her husband honor for what he'd done for 20 years in the church, some genius, and she's not sure. And she said, well, Friday's saying, no, it was pretty good. She said, well, all I knew how to do was to be a teacher, which is what she was, because Carol and I met them in when was that, 1988, October 28th, 1988. So she's saying she's a teacher, and she said, well, all I knew how to do was to be a teacher. So she went into the subgenius camp and treated everybody as, you know, grade two people. That's how she talked to them. And I guess some found it funny, and some didn't. And she wasn't sure whether it was funny. And then she found out that Stang missed it, that he had slept through it.
The next day was already not off to a
that's right.
Was
night.
That when yeah. she divorced him?
Well, that's what I'm leading up to. Oh. So about a year later, Stang, she left, kicked Stang out of the house. He reports this. And he said that she had said to him, this fucking ends. I put up with this nonsense for 10, 15, what would it be? 98, almost 20 years. And she says, you cannot continue the Church of Genius after the X day. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He put her foot down, and he couldn't stop it, so he was kicked out. And the only place he could go to was up to Cleveland, because the Einstein Secret Orchestra, which was a pretty good local band, he did a lot of over-the-air, on-air radio jamming with them. So he went up there and hung out there, and then he eventually met a woman from up there and married her. But his first wife, you never heard from again, and she had had enough. She kicked him out. Because
she created that day. She even did a speech at it.
Yes.
He didn't show up for it, and she probably thought, I waited two decades and put up with all this stuff, and it's going over his head.
When he told me in October 28, 1988, that was Bob Tor, that's when we had done May's funeral and met Jerry Fiok in L.A., and a whole new phase started in L.A. because of that. But she told me and Carolyn that... For years, they'd get kids, college kids, coming down, hitchhiking down, and they'd knock on Stang's door, and they would put them up. You know what I mean? Just sort of like a replay of the 60s communal, everybody is helping everybody on the student population. And they told me that after a few years, there were so many idiots that were disgusting as host guests that they do not accept. They'd stopped accepting anybody coming to their home. And so she told me that. She had put her foot down on that level. Well, I'm not putting up with these idiotic people you're attracting through the Church of the Subgenius. So I got an inkling that she had standards at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could say bourgeois standards. So it's understandable that she would not put up with this. And I certainly, in my ongoing battle with Stang, that he continues out of cowardice, I love telling stories like this. It drives him up the wall.
It's funny when you mentioned about so-called bourgeois stories, and this is a lot of thing, obviously, in the Western world. People go in, and I know, you know, just on a private level, that William Irwin Thompson, you know, his theme a lot is that whole thing. Do you join the institution, which then eventually becomes corrupt and ultimately stifles creativity, or are you on the outside? And the thing is, if you're on the outside, and when you're young, you want to be an underground artist, and you want to do the right thing, and you feel, and you know, in the now that you have, you're eternal. And so you don't really make a lot of other plans, and you plan, you know, on couch surfing all your life and that kind of thing. And eventually, you know, you realize, what am I getting out of it? I do have to address all these, you know, mundane chemical body things, and I haven't been taking care of them, and now I have to take care of them, and I don't feel like doing it. And so
I've been taking drugs for years, so I don't have my left hemisphere to handle college anymore. I can't do college, and then you get in trouble. That's when you really get in trouble, because you got no money, and you got someone pregnant, and you got a kid. You have several friends in that boat.
Yeah, that's right. then you get provider panic or whatever. So
yeah.
But Ben, what I was, especially if suddenly if you're going to have kids and you're like in that whole thing, I don't. There's not one specific, but if you're kind of intelligent, you're thinking, geez, I can't make it in a liberal arts kind of thing. Seriously, I would quickly go and do a crash course over about a year and a half or something in plumbing or something that is like
that's your retrospect
skill to have that you can go and
get. Dave. Okay, we got that. Now you were right on the border of Glenn and those guys, your friends that end up in trouble. You were in trouble after Adam Vaughn kicked you out of CKLN, so that was the end of your journalistic career, and you got to Sinclair and you had a little hit locally on New Music, City Music, whatever, but there you had no money, and we're in touch, and that's why, and you didn't go get the course, but that's where Nelson really gave you something. When he gave you
big
the
shot
money,
in the arm.
Yeah, to make the Boss Media Ecology albums in December 1990 and the McLuhan album. If you had not gotten that money, you would, that next year, 91, probably would have to either go homeless or get a course and then not do the music, right?
Exactly. That's what I would have done. I would have gone into a different field.
Right. And then you then got through that, then started to make it and do things, and you survived that risky late, 22 to 25 period. Your friends didn't, but you did survive. And went on to become the greatest musician of your, producer of your generation.
Yeah, notice Bob when he said that, it's like he's putting quotes on it, and it's like...
Yes, I'm qualifying.
I squeamish. I get squeamish.
Yeah, Dave is very self-conscious and shy, but we all know Dave's always great.
No, I mean, I'm in the credits and all that, but I don't think I'm that great. But
you know why you're great,
like
Dave? You're great because as you're talking to these kids that you're teaching how to do stuff, and they come in and rip you off and all that stuff, that period, you're thinking, Bob knowledge about the phenomenon. There's no one else who has Bob knowledge, and you probably even entertain them with your opinions, and you put the Bob knowledge in there, and you are an interesting conversationalist to them, right? They never heard the kind of opinions you have because you put the McLuhan and this stuff in there.
And we have it on record. Hey, guys. We have it on record. Brendan Crosscarry, who's working with you right now, gave us a review of what it's like to work with Dave. He said Dave does all the work.
Yeah.
He says he actually works like a producer. I just have to be the musician, and Dave does all the work. So there you go.
And if Brendan was interested, he could have very interesting conversations on all kinds of stuff.
Oh, fun. Well, we became instant friends, actually. We got, in some ways, we spent half the time yakking and laughing and another half working, which I like. That's how I like to work. I'd rather
Well, you
spend...
apparently do imitations of me to some people.
Of course.
Yeah.
But what, I'd rather spend 10 hours having fun getting 3 hours work done than to have 3 hours of unmagical time, get it done, and then go, then, well, what should we do, watch a movie? Or
You want to get the subgenius part of them come out. And then
part of the process and experience, and then maybe it infuses into the material.
Yeah, so I'm saying you're great because you can, if they are capable, you can give them a whole other conversational experience that they would never get from anywhere else.
I think so, because most producers, especially nowadays, music's very conservative now, so you're supposed to deliver a product that doesn't offend anyone. So as long as you do that, no one's going to say, I don't like this. So you make sure, so I hate when it's called product. I mean, when I was a kid, the only people that called music product or units, we would say those words to mock the fact that it had been corporatized and was sold by T-shirts.
And Zappa used to satirize that. He'd call it units to mock the accountants and take it
off
the industry.
Kids don't give a shit. Now they call it units, too, because they're aspiring to get a good job selling records or something, or being a, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That represents, oh, I see, that's economically viable or something. So that's the other shift, too, is that people, I think, out of the economic collapse, there is no... Everything is all mixed together. You don't want, even if you're doing alternative underground music, you want to get it on a Volkswagen ad. It's like you don't exist unless you're part of the corporate environment. So that's an interesting thing, how everything absorbed into itself.
Okay, Dave, that's where I call it quadrophenia, and the younger generations are maybe smarter for that. They can be put on the mask of the independent artist and the creative artist against the system, but they also include their chartered accountant self keeping the books on a Friday. They can meet with the lawyer.
Andy Warhol did that.
Yeah.
Andy Warhol kind of represented that.
Yes. And Zappa. Zappa was the first rock musician who didn't take drugs and could talk business with guys. You know what I mean? And most of them had their managers do it, and then they got ripped off, you know?
Yes.
Zappa eventually had all his albums. He bought it all back. So he could have incredible control over his output.
And nobody, Prince, I believe, bought his stuff back as well.
Right. So the later generations are more comprehensive, and what we call quadraphenic. So they might be. This is the, we don't know how charismatic that is. You know what I mean? You survive, but you may not have the romantic charisma of the maniac that's not paying attention to everything.
I think that's why music all kind of sounds samey too, because
yeah.
A lot of people, and that's where it's like there isn't almost like indie music is or they call independent music. It's just not. It's just aspiring to be just a slight variant on the Britney Spears and the Beyonce, and still hit all those you know basic qualities that music has to hit for lots of people to like it immediately.
Yeah, they're not obviously doing a song. They put in sound effects or twists and synth clavier stuff, which I like. A lot of the mainstream music now has collage stuff happening all the time.
Yeah, but the vocals are usually really loud. You know what I mean? It always hits certain things that a radio song must hit. And so when everyone's making music, they feel career or economically wise, what they're making will not really be viable unless they're trying to compete in that form. And that's what I've seen the last few years where it's kind of boring on a certain level because it's like, oh, my God, it's all merging the sound. A lot of house
music. And that's the significance. Now we come to the point, Dave. The significance of the Bob Fest is we show a new way to do music, and it's music based on fun vibes and speech and ideas and ion. It's in John Cage's idea, any sound is music. We are musical, but we include conversation, ideas, and everything as part of our music, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it makes a unique, fun vibe that music always represented, but doesn't often have that now. We represent the fun of music.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
or also
idea.
Do those Balinese. We've gone Balinese. Everything is art.
Everything is science here, Dave. We have no science. Everything we do is science. We have no fun. Everything we do is fun. See, that's good. We can update that famous quote. We have no accounting. Everything we do is accounting. We have no insanity. Everything we do is insane.
Yes, we have no fun. Everything we do is fun.
For those that don't understand it, McLuhan quoted this famous, the Balinese over in Asia said, we have no art. Everything we do is art. And
that's
we're playing
brilliant.
Off that quote.
But we're more in that milieu, hey? We're all at once.
We have no medicine.
Like, how can there be a separation?
That's right. We have no oxygen. Everything we do is oxygen. See, you don't make the categories. That's pre-lunar attack.
And you also see that thing that everyone is trying to express themselves. Come see my music. Come hear my song. Come hear everyone.
Right.
So it's almost like, look, did you see the dress I wore today? It was awesome. No, I missed it. Shit, well, I got some photos of it.
Yeah. And then you can actually show people your photos on Facebook. So that retrieves all the analog media. But here's what we're really trying to say. We have no non-physical. Everything we do is non-physical. You like that one, eh, Carolyn? Put that on the website. We have no non-physical. Everything we do is non-physical. That's it, Dave. That's the third phase of technological evolution.
Wow.
Whoa.
That's some chewy food for thought.
Yeah, chewy food for, thinking and chewing. And.
There's a good statement to end on.
Yes, we shall now go to the old-fashioned evergreens, slow, carefully modulated, avant-garde for 1990.
Oh, just before we go.
Stop it, Dave.
Yeah. You hear that?
No, because this is really important. No, it's not long, and it's just so important. If you stop me, you'll make a big mistake.
All right, okay.
Listen, it could be fatal.
No,
it could be.
I can handle it. I'm a doctor.
I know, this is true.
No,
well, that's why I'm about to say it, because you're around.
We have no fatal day. Everything we do is fatal, Dave.
Natural-born killers, remember.
Yes. Go ahead, Dave. Quick.
Okay, here's where we end it, because Carolyn comes in line. I'm listening to that Evergreens tape. They're going on about the mushrooms and all that. And then the next thing I write down, I go, listen to the young Connie on the tape. I don't know if the tape is set up.
Yeah, that's right.
Like, so funny.
Like
12 years old or something.
Yeah. The little girl.
I'm looking at it right now. Look at the time when that one went through. 1:22:14.
Perfect. I actually saw that number. And isn't it 1:22 to the left of it or 19? There's another relevant number right beside the 1:22:14. Look, to the left of it.
Says day 207 at 1:22:14. I just did the copy like I did the select all.
Yeah, 1:22. It's person number 1:22, I think.
Seven.
207.
Oh, just seven? All right. I noticed that last night, unless it was one of many.
Okay, so you've been able to see, so Ginny's right. All the stuff, or most of it's been retrieved anyways.
Yes, I would go back and forth and get quick glances the last 3 days. Yeah.
I
missed a lot. And during a long recording, I would start reading it all.
Yes.
But it was so busy, Dave, that people were posting so quickly, it kept jogging the thing and moving it away from my eyes. You know what I mean?
Yeah, not only that, we're on about a 40-second delay, too, so sometimes we're responding to stuff. So you can imagine Bob, within a minute, has already, like, gone around the world 8 times.
Right. Yeah. And this LSD, September 28th, 1990, after we had been at Walter Boris in Paradise, Arizona, this is session number 22, and it's a special one.
Turn up your radios?
Turn up the radio.
Mobile phones, because you're about to play the tape, right? You're giving me.
Right, well, I might have to look for a minute, so you can keep. Carolyn, what were you scolding Dave about?
That, Mr. Evergreen, how are you today? When you tell me something I want to know, I used to get so mad at them because I'd ask them a question and they would give me an answer. I'd come back the next month and I'd say, you were totally wrong. And it took me years for them to finally say, oh, well, you should be asking us about the percentage of possibility, probability of that happening, and then ever afterwards, what percentage agreement do you have with this statement, you bunch of crap?
Yeah, Carolyn had a problem with the Evergreen from the beginning, but she discovered that we were supposed to ask what percentage their prediction was valid.
So when you date tapes, you can usually tell that's one from after this period.
Yes, that's right. But it's not as squealy. What you hear is a little girl with a normal little girl voice, but not as bad as Carolyn just presented it. But it is definitely a little girl voice, right, Dave? This is what you're hearing.
It's really cute. I mean, that's why I thought, maybe the tape for the sun cassette. You know, the speed
old.
Can be a little different.
Dave, she's 60 years old in the early 80s. Little kid voice.
It's before all the alcohol and cigarettes and drugs.
The party and the fame and the paparazzi and all the appearances and the hotels.
The paparazzi and the appearances, that's right. The medical new age circuit. The new age. That's
horrible. Go through that and come out even stronger.
And there's always Shannon's great statement, of course, I owe it all to Bob, but I believed in myself. I think that's very nice way she said that. I owe it all to Bob, but I believed in myself.
Are you multitasking, Bob, or are you just ignoring what you're supposed to be doing?
Multi-vocalizing.
You're multi-voking.
Yeah. Hey. Well, I'm trying to get organized here to find out where it begins, the LSD thing. I have to... That's why, Dave, talk to Carolyn, or anybody else talk.
Get some sort of editor? I mean, it's way too late for this now, but isn't there an editor that can be more precise for you to be able to find timing?
No, this is a list I've made that I worked out several weeks ago.
I know, but when you go to the QuickTime or whatever, it seems to be so broad. You could be within 2-3 minutes of where you want to be. Why can't it be precise?
It is, but it's an email to myself.
No, you're not getting what I'm saying. I'm saying that we spend an inordinate amount of time, wasted timing. Yesterday when you kept trying to find the right spot and skip over spots.
Right.
Instead of being able to fine-tune it to the second. You know, we'd be listening for 30 seconds of dead air while the...
Oh, yeah. You mean my precise arrow?
Yeah, there is no preciseness.
Well, this is on iTunes. It's not precise on iTunes, unless Ed has some software that makes it more precise.
Uh-huh.
You're talking about, like, I have it here, and I try to go back
to
seconds.
Bob, use your hands on your computer. Don't be wiping your hands in front of me telling me what you're doing. Moved your hands away from the computer.
Yeah, I'm going
to
show you.
Talk to me.
Yeah, look.
I want your hands on your computer.
Why?
find the clip.
No, I found it, but I want to show you. It's here.
Bob's got his hands up in prayer.
122.
He's praying I don't throw this at him.
Yeah, 122. Yeah. And I want to move back to 118, but when I move back, it goes to 90. You know, it goes back to 30
points.
I know.
Just use the cursor. Use the cursor then.
So you're saying, can we get a better cursor? That's
yeah, get some software.
I don't think you can for iTunes, but.
Oh, no. Come on. People do not.
Is Ed Long here? Ed Long showed me how to do QuickTime fine tuning.
Editing.
Can
you
do it on iTunes, Ed? I guess he's not here. Okay, so.
Okay, Bob.
Technical on line one, please. Technical on line one.
Yeah,
Ed,
yeah.
Ed, can we get an Ed?
Support.
Tech support.
No, not
on line
one. Aisle five. Tech. Aisle five. Clean
Sarah
up.
Had a comment. What, Sarah?
Drag the cursor. Click on the button and drag the cursor.
Yeah, he's doing that, but it seems to overskip, and I've noticed that too.
iTunes is horrible. I don't ever use.
Okay, there's Sarah. No, in other words, they don't offer software for iTunes.
Right, Sarah would know.
Right, okay, good. End of story.
What do you use, Sarah?
Everything.
Typically, I use Windows Media Player personally, is the easiest to adjust like that.
Right.
But if I really want to get into something, I just throw it into Audacity.
Of what speed?
Audacity. I've heard of that, yeah.
Audacity.
And yeah, we're getting close.
When people put their MP3s in that, and what does that enable you to do with them?
Anything you want, really. Any kind of
manipulation.
Sort of
organize it.
But if you want, I mean, you can throw it into a phaser, reverse bouncing ball, equalize
okay.
it. Then you can reverse that, throw it into a G-verb, they call it, instead of reverb. Then you can reverse it, play it forward, and compress it down. You can change the vibration. You can change it to the exact millisecond, things like that.
It's more like a sound editing program with the plug-in effects kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's easy to use if you want.
So you're the one that's been manipulating the tapes and changing names and putting stuff in different orders. Okay, it's good we know. Science things.
Hey, Dave, what were we saying? We have no art. We have no fail. We do.
We have no non-physical. What is it?
We do everything.
Everything we do is non-physical.
Everything we do, because someone just quoted probably the correct statement.
For the Balinese.
No, yeah, we have no art. We do everything as well as possible. That's probably
what. Oh, that's beautiful. That's beautiful.
But I want to do what we did, so I didn't want to forget it. So I got you to say it one more time before we get altered by the factual one. So
yes.
What is it? We have no
non-physical. Everything we do is non-physical.
So we switch. We do everything to everything we do. That's we switch the word order there.
Yes,
everything
yes.
we do is baseball. Okay, well we have arrived at this point. This is it. You're going to hear an awesome session, a detailed explanation of the brain and what happens on LSD, and then later compared to mescaline. This is an incredible session. September 28th, 1990, and everything, we got everything, the volume, we got to mute everybody. How was the voting? How's the voting going? Is any of this probably forgotten? Anybody tabling about what musician we vote with, we go with? Here's Sider Somerset. I have liked a combination of Evergreen tapes, Ion material, and the interaction live and on here is still a bit jumbled, but it's been a fun ride. So, yeah, we had four levels, four kind of like a quadrophenia.
I vote for Duke Edwards again. Maybe a different one.
Say that louder.
A different Duke, another Duke Edwards, maybe?
You mean to just play the only one we have, or what?
Oh, that's the only one you have. Maybe not.
Would you like to hear it for a second? He's on your mind?
No, I got the YouTube open right here. I can listen to it whenever
okay.
I want.
All right. But that's a great... That one we do have is good, isn't it? It's a great song.
Oh, my God.
One-hit wonder. Okay, here we go. Did I mute? I don't think I muted. Okay, you're on your own.
All participants are now muted.
How long is a while?
I don't know. It depends on how this goes. 20, 30 minutes at least.
Okay, not an hour and 20 minutes of bike.
On the greetings, man.
The reading Carol and I had on September 18th, you discussed Carol's experience with mescaline, and you gave a description of how it seems to work on our sensorium. I was interested if you could explain what LSD does to our bodies and the experience that happens to people under, you know, very good quality LSD.
LSD itself does affect the sensorium. However, it cross certain mental barriers, especially those barriers associated with the other than the sensorium, in that it affect the portions of the brain associated with seeing, associated with the touch, etc. Now, these are the perceptive organs, perceptive portions of the brain. It affects those. The sensorium itself is little touched, but the amount of information that is then feeding back from these organs that sense, of course, realize they must have a pattern within themselves in order to sense, and the patterns begin to go back into the sensorium. It's different than mescaline, because mescaline work on the sensorium itself. It have, the sensorium have a tendency to draw upon the organs of sensation, while LSD have a tendency to push from the senses into the sensorium.
But that means sort of like the nerves of sensing of the sensory organs then are affected rather than the sensorium.
Yes.
And where is the sensorium in the skull, you know, inside?
The reticular formation.
Where is that? Do you know about
it? Right in the absolute center, the most protected portion of the brain itself.
Now, what about the hypothalamus and the thalamus? Where is that? Over
that is part of that.
So that's the most intimate part of the human brain.
Exactly.
Particular.
Yes.
And is that connected to the animal part? What's the part we have at the base of the brain?
There are three brains.
Yeah, let's just review that.
There is that which is termed a primal brain, and that is a very low senses of itself. Then the next up is what would be described as the brachination brain, associated with simian learning. And then there is the forebrain, the cortex, full cortex of the brain, the upper brain. Now, connecting all of this is the reticular formation itself.
That includes the hypothalamus.
Yes, all within that grouping. Now, the point is, take mescaline, and the sensorium itself changes subtly so that it can draw upon the sense perception organs of the brain. It draws upon them. The taking of LSD, because it does affect at the level of the nerves, causes firing of these senses, which are then perceived by the sensorium. So, it could be seen that one is creative and one is imposed.
Which one's creative?
Mescaline.
One's imposed on the sensorium?
Well, and that's LSD.
Yeah, you impose on the sensorium, is what you meant there.
Mm.
Yeah. Now, does the sensorium, this deepest part of the brain, the most, what do we call it, the most precious part?
Term it that,
yeah.
Yes.
Did apes have that part? Or is that a human part?
No, all primates have that.
All right. Does it connect to psychic experiences and other dimensions? Is that a core part that relates to that?
Mm-hmm. It itself can, yes.
All right, now, Tim Leary, in discussing and writing about LSD, he put much spiritual emphasis on it, and he made a book paralleling the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is, you know, a religious manifesto and tradition from Tibet in that area that describes the process that the soul goes through when they die, when one dies. Leary made a parallel with the experiences on LSD and claimed you go through these death experiences on LSD, though you don't die. Is his parallel accurate, or is he exaggerating the, shall we call, the spiritual part of LSD? Is he exaggerating the spiritual meaning of LSD?
He's exaggerating it because, realize that if you would describe LSD as an inward experience, that would be a good description. Because realizing all of the data that is stored in a particular portion of the brain, let's just choose one, the eyes. The eyes connect to a certain portion of the brain that is responsible for seeing. Now, in that portion of the brain that is responsible for seeing, there is a pattern recognition program. LSD trigger that and force the sensorium of the brain to perceive that which it is firing to the sensorium.
Right.
But only pattern recognition. But it is so, I term it, not coherent.
So what?
It's not so coherent. It's incoherent.
Yeah.
And because it is incoherent, the sensorium tries to make sense of it. Tries to make a rational of it.
And this is perceived by the user as a very tense drama, right? To make sense of it.
Yes. Look at a person on LSD. Shine a bright light at them. The eyes perceive it. The portion of the brain that is responsible for seeing perceives it. But what message does it send to the sensorium? Of random. Incoherent. The sensorium tries to make sense of it. And says that it is being inundated by white rays, that it is whatever, 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 depending upon the state of mind of the individual taking it.
Yeah.
LSD is also location dependent. LSD given in a clinical situation will produce one result. Taken in a group meeting where there is guitars and singing, then a different environment. But of all of these, mescaline is different. Mescaline will be relatively consistent no matter what situation is taken.
Okay, what is the drama that goes on, the internal voice that's talking and either getting exhilarated by the, you can help me on this if you want, getting exhilarated by the sensory confusion or getting panicky, is that a physiological part of ego? It's not a soul thing that Leary makes out, because he says, you know, you're killing your ego and it's a spiritual thing. That's exaggerating just the effect of sensory confusion?
Exactly.
And you're implying mescaline is the most spiritual, if you want to put that kind of implication on matter.
Yes. Now, the other side of this is that LSD confuses the sensory organs so that the pattern is disturbed. Realize how long it took you to learn to see. It took you time to learn to see. You had to form the pattern and to learn to see. Now, that pattern established in yourself is then set awry by LSD, forming a new pattern. So therefore, when a person have, quote, flashbacks, unquote, they're just accessing that pattern that has been disturbed and is now a new pattern.
So the LSD does not affect the sensorium, the thalamus, and the hypothalamus, as someone once told me it does. It affects it indirectly.
Indirectly it's affected,
yeah.
Yes.
And certainly not on a spiritual or positive way.
No.
So, all right. Now, just to go along another direction, is the Tibetan Book of the Dead an accurate description of the process of physical death and what happens when you go into the other dimensions?
It's accurate to its own belief system.
Yeah.
Realizing that every society has its approach to death. So if you would take the Egyptian Book of the Dead, with the emphasis on Osiris and Styx, you see, one must cross that river. Culturally, that entire society was river-oriented. They lived by the river. They died by the river. It killed them, and it fed them. It was central to their existence and central to their continuance. If you look into the Tibetan Book of the Dead, it will then cause another view of a society. Each society dies to its own belief conventions.
That would mean, Evergreens, that what people experience after death then would be somewhat or completely a result of their belief system.
Exactly.
That they had before they died.
Yes.
And so none of it's really true.
Oh, it's very true. To the person who was doing this, exactly. That is comfort. Death is fear. So you must overlay death with a belief system of what happened at death.
Is that why people go to sleep after they die for a while sometimes?
Oftentimes.
And they have to go through that dream?
Because they have such a belief system that if they did not, then total confusion, total loss of self.
Well, does one meet their relatives and loved ones, so to speak, when you die, or is that all in this imaginary dream state?
No, it's not in the imaginary dream state, but when there is a dream state created, oftentimes in the dream state, those relatives, friends, associates, etc., will enter the dream to pull the person out of the dream.
So there's a death experience beyond this belief system.
Exactly.
Which is what you know.
Yes.
When you say you know, what's that?
The Evergreens.
You mean, yeah, is there surveillance of humans as they die by this other dimension? You can call it the astral plane, is that the
term? Term it whatever you want.
The astral plane. Are they surveilling and helping people through, and they have to kind of monitor people's consciousnesses when they come through?
Not so much monitor, but allow the person to live his belief system so that they can enter the belief system and alter it. Now, consider the number of ways that we have cast off clay, the number of societies that we have belonged to. We belong to a considerable number of societies, from hunter societies simple farming to advanced societies. Now, each one of these had a different Book of the Dead. Now, a near-death experience to a person in a hunting community would be associated with, quote, the happy hunting grounds. You see?
And that imagery manifests to them in their dream state.
Because that is what is necessary for them. Take a Christian near-death experience. With a white light at an end of a tunnel to be greeted by Jesus. You see?
I was going to mention the near-death description. Some people say they are quite common beyond cultures.
Beyond cultures. Oh, yes.
What is that basic common thing that happens?
The basic common thing is that very strongly culturally oriented. Very strongly.
That's what happened. You're saying that's... Mm. But what about the white light that everybody, every culture sees?
You see, term it this way. Not every culture sees that white light in the same way.
But it's there. There's some manifestation of energy.
It's there. However, how it's perceived is culturally... based.
The user is the content, to use McLuhan's phrase.
Yes, very much so.
The user of that consciousness, soul energy that we all have is mutated by each culture.
Yes.
Now, there is another dimension. There's a consensus reality on the astral plane, if you call it. You know, something that once you get out of your dream state and get used to the shock of death, whatever it takes, then you are then communicating with souls. You
know what I mean?
In like a city, so to speak.
Well, yes, that would be a useful description.
And I get from when we did the JFK assassination that the souls of some of the people involved in the assassination were there. It sounds like there's an ESP communication, a very high sensitivity among souls on this dimension, after-death experience.
And the best word to use in that is resonance.
Yeah, it's amazing resonance between millions of souls, right?
Between... billions of souls, yes.
And they're all communicating, and I mean, they're not interfering with each other, but they're very sensitive. We are very sensitive when we're dead to this stuff, to this
presence.
This presence of everybody else, right?
Yes.
And that's why it's very hard for you to describe to us that experience, because it's very different from the isolation of consciousness on this dimension, right?
In that, yes. And still certain descriptions can be given in that term it that you would have a radio that's on to all channels.
And you can absorb all channels at once.
And be able to perceive that which to which you would direct yourself.
Right, so yeah, it's not a multi-level noise going on. You just can tune into anything that you want.
You can be focused and focused at the same time.
Yes.
But you're focusing.
But also,
but then you could defocus and you can absorb all the multi-level, what would maybe in this dimension appear to be noise. You're more adept in this other dimension to perceive the multi-levelness.
Yes.
And take in a lot more, so to speak.
Yes. And the reason being is that... You see, when a soul casts up clay from this dimension, he is that personality. The soul of the person is still the person.
Mm-hmm.
He is still the person. However, the term it to the next stage of, quote, death, unquote, is learning how many personalities you've been, and where, and when, and for what reason.
And you're capable of computing that?
Yes.
Or do you have to practice? Do you have to get used to it?
No, it has been it is so oft-times done that, yes, it did require practice, but it no longer requires practice.
You mean earlier in consciousness's evolution it required practice?
In the earlier evolution of the decision of souls to choose, when you can choose between one rock and another rock, and you've only done it once, you have to correlate. Now, to correlate all of the existences, it's not as hard. It's easier.
So that whatever you call consciousness that transcends these different dimensions, you know, the thing that sort of comes here and then goes, dies and goes and operates on that dimension, that is learning new ways of relating itself. You know what I mean? Death is not a concrete zone that's finite. It's an evolving tool in our way to interact between the two dimensions.
Exactly. One important point here is that when one is reunited with memories, reunited with self, reunited with fullness, term it that,
yes,
then the life is examined. It's examined from all of its various activities, inactions, actions, etc. So the person have then the overview of the existence. But we assure you it's far more complicated than this. Far more complicated.
Yeah, and so once I heard the Evergreens was said, someone told me, maybe Ellie, that many souls are there wondering what to do next. Whether to when to reincarnate or wondering what there was a questioning, hanging around kind of expression. I guess.
It's an examination. But realize that from that perspective, you've lived the life already and already know what you've learned from it.
So that's part of the learning. Is you could get
which you do.
Which we do what?
Live it again.
Yeah, now does one make a choice when to reincarnate, or is there a consensus people agree?
There is always discussion, but it's always choice.
Right, but it seems to be that there's a dialogue going on between souls that you have been involved more with than others.
Oh, yes.
So they're little gangs, or maybe that's too hard of a term, little cliques of souls that when they die, they say, well, I was involved with you a lot, and what are we going to do the next time? This kind of thing goes on?
But they will then examine that life that they have had lived and will live.
And the
clique. It's the same life.
Yeah, and they examine their clique interaction, so to speak.
And look at it. You see, that is one of the things that make it somewhat problematic to understand. As we say, the objective of all of this is to experience everything in the universe but one thing, and that is reuniting with God. It's the one thing that has not been experienced. Then the life of the soul is complete. Realize that it's already happened.
That we've reunited.
Yes. But at the same time, it is not. There will be no need for reincarnation.
Yeah, it has not. And then you said, so there's no need for reincarnation.
If there would be no need, since there is, but since there is simultaneously not, then there is a need for reincarnation.
I think if one can accept, I don't want to say passively accept, but I feel that I can understand the ambiguity of consciousness in these other levels more and more in this body, and I don't know if it's a problem for me. I don't feel I'm united with God already, but I know that it will get better or more sophisticated or something.
Yes.
And that is part of God, is the unfolding of this time thing.
Mm. Well, you can tell you one thing. We have searched for God ourselves and have not found God yet.
yet you know you have it. You experience it pretty good up there. You experience quite an intimacy there, don't you?
Oh, an intimacy, yes. But not discovered God.
And you probably won't.
Ah.
you respond to that? You probably won't?
We will.
Evergreens, isn't it true, though, that what we... Is this some kind of just something we hang on to believe that, that God is inside of us? That we are a part of God?
In other words, searching for ourselves.
Yeah.
Well, it seems to be the nature of consciousness. It's like an after image or an incompleteness that's necessary to be consciousness. And if you really perceive that, then you accept it more. But you can't stop consciousness trying to complete itself.
Exactly.
Okay, so we, at the same time, we have God, and at the same time, we do not.
Yes.
Which is the nature of consciousness, which is God.
Exactly.
It's a simple, it's a membrane, like I call it the tip of the finger.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I understand it.
You're touching your tactility as you think of it.
Yes.
Nothing more needs sense, almost, but we will continue leaking language, I call it, leaking language.
Yes, it's not only leaking language, but the fascination of it is that in the search for God, the more we find ourselves.
That's almost what I think of the Christian faith, and it's in other religions, but of cultural optimism, or of the loving to be alive, because you have a basic optimism that you're going to get better. It's going to get better, and you're going to you just don't get depressed about it.
Exactly.
And if people forget that, though, but that's part of the joke of consciousness, is that you momentarily fall asleep.
Yes.
It's hypnosis, and I always thought that Marshall meant that in the metaphor of his writings, Marshall McLuhan. Every present is an invisible environment, and you see the past.
Mm.
That, to me, is what we just talked about. Mm. Consciousness is an invisible environment, yet you see it and experience it, but it's incomplete.
And every sense added changes consciousness.
Yes. And then you can go beyond. Then you go to metaphors of technologies as extensions of sense.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, Which affect consciousness. Yes.
And it's amazing how this thing that's ever there is affected. Yet it's kind of like a crystal, hard crystal that's never changed.
Mm.
So it never... It seems that life is to be experienced.
Oh, yes.
But part of the experience is that you're experiencing other consciousness that will interact and interfere with your experiencing of it.
Well, as we say, the objective of life is to experience experiencing.
Yeah. And to say that does not stop what's going to happen, or the problems that are going to happen?
Not at all.
Does it at all, does it? Yet saying is very much of experience.
Exactly.
And experiencing at the soul level or spiritual level is also the same purpose. What you do, whether you're talking to Michael or whether you're just communicating with other minds or other souls...
In another dimension.
In that dimension.
Yeah.
That's experiencing.
That's still experience.
Okay, I have some... Cool. All right, so in history... according to the history of the Evergreens talking in the booklet, Visitors from Time and Space, I think I recall that there wasn't much interaction between extraterrestrials and civilizations since about 4,000 or 6,000 BC, the time of Adam and Eve and our myth, Christian myth.
Yes.
Before that, there were periodic alterations or interactions with humanity.
Yes.
Now, the Evergreens explained to us a year ago or so that you're a new attempt to communicate and interact with this dimension. All right?
Yes.
This is a new evolutionary agreement or scenario you guys have worked out to attempt this now. It would not have been done before.
Because consciousness was not the same.
Yeah. So when I hear about people talking about... The popularity of some Indian cultures, of the Cherokee, I can't remember her name, Diane Wahoo, she writes books about their culture, their secret religious societies had stories of being in touch with UFOs and extraterrestrial intelligence way back in their past, and this was precious knowledge in their culture.
Yes.
And I say, well, we have contact now with a new thing. We don't have to. We can appreciate the past experience that it could have happened and seems to have happened. But with the evergreens, we can now have a more immediate and more amazing interaction, more profitable, rather than worrying about past attempts. You know what I mean?
Well, because consciousness is different.
Yeah, we have a new contact, and it's not that the evergreens are extraterrestrial, but there's been mediumship through history. This is a new form of mediumship, a more accomplished form of mediumship, which would naturally happen right now because consciousness has evolved to this complexity here and where you are.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to... Is that okay? I'm doing all talking here, but it's good to get their response or nods.